to you, some old and some new. Okay, some regulars and some irregulars. No, that's not better?
That doesn't work for that.
Familiar or unfamiliar. We will, for those of you who've watched, we dealt with House Bill 2029 and 2031 yesterday, so those will not be on the agenda. We have public hearing on two bills, 2299 and 2300. We'll take those in reverse order and begin with a public hearing on House Bill 2300. Open that, and Steve, do you want to give us the report first?
Hey, House Bill 2300 deals with equalizing the local option levies that school districts now have authority to issue. It does that by setting up a target amount of assessed value per student, and it sets that target at where the 25 districts are above it and 75% of the districts are below it, so it's at the 75th percentile. Then for those districts that are below the assessed value per student of that target district would be eligible for grants. And it sets up the calculation of the grant as being the tax rate times the difference in assessed value between the district assessed value and the target assessed value, and that times the number of students in the district. And it's based on ADM, not weighted ADM. And then finally, it sets up a local option equalization grants account, and where appropriations would have to be made into that account, and then if insufficient funds were in the account to pay all of the equalization grants, then the grants would be prorated.
Okay. Thanks. Let's welcome up Gene Thorne. Gene, do you have anyone you want to bring with you?
Where do I start?
Okay.
Bring Department of Ed some state.
Okay.
Well, implement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Jean Thorne, the Governor's Education and Workforce Policy Advisor. House Bill 2300 is actually the Governor's proposal for implementing legislation around one portion of Measure 1. And for those of you who may remember, this is one of the, 26 ballot measures that was on the ballot. It was one of them that passed. There were a couple of components with Measure 1, and one of them related to sufficiency of funding to meet quality goals, and if insufficient, there were certain reporting requirements for the legislature, and there's a separate bill on that that's being heard in House Education Committee. I forget the name. It's a very long name. The second part of Measure 1 actually refers to establishing some equalization grants for local option to try to address issues of inequality, I would say, of opportunity for districts based on the type of property, the level of property wealth they may have. And some of you may remember this concept was discussed last session as the local option bill was discussed. Obviously, different districts with different levels of property wealth can raise varying amounts of funding on a per student basis. And for example, when you array school districts by the property wealth per student or per ADM, if you looked at, and actually what I'll do is walk you through probably simply the attached chart, and if there are technical questions, I'm sure Nancy Hogman from the Department of Education will be able to answer those. But for instance, if you look at, I think the key columns on the attached chart are the second one, the assessed value per ADM, and then the last one, the maximum state equalization grant. But just looking, for instance, at this chart, and these have the school districts arrayed in order of assessed value per ADM. If you're in the black, since I'm not too sure where Gentura is, but I know where Black Butte is, and probably most of you do, if you were in the Black Butte school district, and Black Butte levied 10 cents per $1,000 of assessed value, they could raise $137 per student. On the other end of the spectrum, however, is Nissa school district. Nissa, which only has an assessed value of $115,000 per student, if it levied a local option of 10 cents per thousand, it could only raise $12 per student. So the intent of the measure and then of this bill is to try to bring some equalization to that, not in terms of penalizing school districts that have a high property wealth, but those that have lower property wealth, to provide a supplemental state grant to provide a supplement to assist them in, I would say, in bringing equal access to a local option. Now, this doesn't deal with the fact that in some school districts, the voters may not be inclined to vote for additional money for schools no matter what. It doesn't deal with the political end of it. What it does deal with, though, is the issue of this variation in property wealth. So as you walk through this chart, then, with the 198 school districts, basically, if you look at the first 50, which would be the top percentile, you would come down to the Beaverton School District, which has an assessed value per ADM of $411,000. So districts above that level that passed a local option would not receive a supplemental state grant. But for those that are below that level, if they passed a local, this is not a grant that they get no matter what, they have to pass a local option. If they pass a local option, they would receive a state grant that could bring them up to that 75th percentile. If it was GLIDE, their maximum state grant per year would be $3,000 if they passed a local option. The other end of the spectrum, though, is if it was NISA and they passed it, their state grant, maximum state grant, would be $546,000. There is money included in the governor's budget, in the appropriation bill, to fund the grants. We believe it's sufficient both to cover those districts that may have already passed a local option that would qualify. I'll say that most of the local options that have passed so far have been school districts that would not qualify, but there certainly are some that would, and I think you'll be hearing from at least one today. But that would also provide some funds for school districts that in the course of the biennium might pass a local option that would qualify. There is, as Steve noted, there's language that if the need goes beyond the amount that is appropriated, that the Department of Education would prorate that amount. So we believe it's a responsible way to bring some equity to opportunity, really, for school districts that pass a local option and provide assistance to those who, because of low property wealth, cannot raise the amount of funds on a per-student basis that those at a higher level could.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Thorne? Yes.
I think. What was the rationale for picking the top 25%?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kafoury, we thought, I mean, frankly, this is patterned after the minority report from the local option last time. And that
Kansas plan, is that what it's called?
I know it's referred to as the, I think Lori Wimmer Whalen is going to speak, and I think she has a little more, she was involved in this last time. I'm not, when I heard more about the Kansas plan later, I think that may have been more also equal, those that passed that were higher property wealth, I think may have had to pass on to lower, and so if that's the Kansas plan, this isn't yet, this provides state grants. I think in terms of the 75th percentile, saying we can't do equity all the way up to the top in terms of it's not affordable to do that, that the 75th percentile seemed to be a reasonable place. You can probably select something beyond there instead of the 75th percentile, but seemed to be a reasonable place to target that as far as of trying to have some substantial equity of opportunity.
Sure.
Yes, Representative Bates.
A statement that I'm going to ask you to do something that maybe makes sense to me. First off, the Kansas plan is we involve a 20-yard line and playoff football game and a tied game. That's how we settle it, you know. I mean, I've heard that Kansas plan, but it's an equitable plan. It works well, and there's no physical repercussions from it, okay? Sometimes things like
thank you for that explanation.
Yeah, I'm sure you wanted to hear that, Gina. Wouldn't let you leave today without knowing it. More importantly, is it possible to walk us through a couple of examples of this, how this would actually work for a high and low district, how one district would affect the other?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, Representative Bates. let me take some that have passed a local option. About five down is Seaside. Seaside has passed a local option. I don't know if they went all the way up to their local option limit, but because they're a higher property wealth district, they've passed their local option, they will not be negatively impacted by this, but they would not receive any additional state funding. And again, this is a separate pot of money in the governor's budget that's set aside. It's not part of the state school fund formula, so it doesn't take away from others. On the other hand, let's go to the last page, because I know you'll be hearing from them, second from the top, Pendleton. Pendleton School District, their local option limit, I think that they may not have, they'll be here to testify, I think they may not have levied quite up to that, but if they had levied this up to $783,000, this would mean they would also receive a state grant in addition to that of $687,000 per year. So those that are, and but the more wealthy you are, well, first of all, if you're in the top 25%, you would not receive anything. If you're a little below that, you receive a little bit of money. If you're a long ways below that, you would receive more money. If the funds were not sufficient to cover all of the way in which we have this budgeted now, we think it is sufficient to cover both those that have passed and those that might, although that's somewhat of an unknown in the next biennium. If there weren't funds sufficient, I imagine there would be two ways that, first of all, perhaps the Department of Education might actually ask for additional e-board money. But absent that, there are provisions in here that would allow them to prorate the funding, and I assume on the same kind of scale that you would have in this. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Mr. Chair, very nicely. A follow-up question?
Yes, sure.
My concern is that very poor districts historically, to my mind, have difficulty getting their local levies passed, and they wouldn't be able to take advantage of this. This is something I suppose nobody can answer. Do you have any information indicating how many districts, especially one of the low tax bases, would actually take part in this program?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bates, actually I looked back on the local option elections that occurred over this last biennium of what didn't pass. And interestingly, on the last page, which is in essence the bottom quartile, there were five of the districts that held a local option. Gladstone, 45% approval, South Umpqua, 49.8%. Hermiston, 34.8%, Gaston, 42.3%, and Willamina, 39.1%. I mean, you'd have to ask the people in those districts, but I know when we were discussing this concept about a year and a half ago, a number of superintendents, although they had some concerns, this is before the governor decided whether he was going to sign the local option bill or not, had, although they had concerns about the local option, felt that having some type of state match, especially for poor districts, could make the difference. So I would not be surprised. I haven't talked to people in these districts, but especially for those that may have attempted a local option and it may have come close, it could be that they would go back out, and being able to say, by passing this, a certain amount of state money will come along with it could make the difference for them.
Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chairman. Gene, I was trying to figure out, as my old law professor said, if I was good at math, I would have gone to med school instead of law school, so maybe you can help me. But focusing...
Let's ask if that's true.
That's not true.
In Section 2, Subsection 3 of the bill, as it sets up a formula... can you just walk me through the formula and help me understand it off, maybe using the formula in the bill and then the chart that you provided?
I'm sorry, on Section 2, Sub...
It's the text that...
It's Sub 3A, where it says, the amount of the local option equalization grant shall equal the product.
Okay.
And about the time it starts to use the word product.
if I might, and I'm looking over across at Nancy Heiligman, and I do... count on technical people from the Department of Education to have worked through some of these, and I don't know if Nancy, this is something you'd be in a position to help walk through.
Certainly, I can try. Mr. Chairman, Representative Williams, for the record, I'm Nancy Heiligman, Director of School Finance for the Department of Education. And the way this formula would work is that it takes the difference in the assessed value per student in the target district, which is at the 75th percentile, in this case, Beaverton School District. And if you look at the printout over the third column from the right, 75th percentile is the $411,000 per student. It would take the difference between the assessed value of the target district and of your own school district that has passed, that is looking at receiving a grant, takes that difference and then applies that to the local option rate that the district would levy or would actually realize as they levied those dollars, and then multiplies it by the number of students and in the district. And what that does is it simply it ensures that you're raising substantially the same number of dollars per student in each district for the same tax rate. And, you know, if we were equalizing 100%, it would be exactly the same amount. We're going to the 75th percentile. So it would mean that if Beaverton levies $1 per thousand and that raises $100 per student, that would be the same in other school districts in the state. So it equalizes taxpayer effort for dollars per student.
Does the formula take into account the experience we've seen in the local options that have passed, where the gap is different on a per property basis and it's uneven throughout the district? This looks like it assumes that there's kind of a static rate across the base, and in fact we've seen that that's not the experience. And does the formula take that into account?
Mr. Chairman, we believe that it does not do that, or that the language needs to be clarified, and the department is proposing a technical amendment to ensure that the equity grant would be based on the actual amount of revenue raised by the school district.
Okay. I think, again, we all assumed one thing at the end of last session, and experience has borne something else out.
Correct.
Other questions? I have one. I'm just curious, again, a technical issue, how the prorating works, because, of course, you're going to have local options approved at different points in time through the biennium. So let's say the legislature appropriates X number of dollars. What's in the governor's budget?
Mr. Chair, we have $5 million in the
governor's budget. $5 million, okay. And then this says that the department would make the equalization grants payable to the school districts entitled on or before December 31 each year. So I assume some amount of that $5 million would be allocated for this year, let's say. And then that would be based just on the number of local options and the districts entitled as of December 31 or whatever point you're making the distribution. And then do you reallocate or reapportion that next year, depending on other districts that may have come online?
Mr. Chairman, we've been looking at alternatives, and we would expect that we would probably treat these grants as we are the facilities grants. And the process you've described is basically what we're doing. We've asked the districts to project to us if they expect to qualify for a grant and what that amount might be. We allocate funds based on those projections and then adjust in the following year.
In this case, though, to report to you that they expect to qualify, doesn't that require that they report that they assume they're going to pass?
Yes, they'd have to be optimistic, yes.
is there a makeup process, either for projections too high and too low, or if you are allocating on a as-you-go basis, you may be giving out too much money or too little, depending on who ultimately qualifies during the biennium?
Mr. Chairman, that, yes, that could be a possibility that we would either over or underestimate. And but that's really the case with all of the state school fund. And we make updated estimates to the school districts about five times each year. And that would just be something we could reestimate as we saw changes.
Mr. Chair. Yes, Representative Hess.
Thank you. I was, someone from the Beaverton School District, I was interested in the target line being drawn right there. And so there's a kind of shifting sands here with property values going up and down. How would that work? Would that change every year? Would, the, mm-hmm. would there be a new target line drawn?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hass, in the way in which the bill is worded, that each year the Department of Revenue provides the information, the latest updated information to the Department of Education, and then they would do that. I think, and if I'm speaking out of term, please tell me, since we're getting into some more technical issues. But I think in most cases, there's not a lot of variation from year to year in terms of the ranking of the school districts, but it would be a yearly process.
Would that line ever be shifted based on the appropriations available, or would the health plan...
Mr. Chair and Representative Hass, the way in which the bill is worded, it establishes the 75th percentile as being, I guess it's discussed in the opposite way, but as being the target district, and then the prorating would continue from there. Given the way we have this established at this point, what we're proposing here, it would take a statutory change to move it to a different percentile.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Doesn't the current local option law cap it at $500 or 10% of the basic ADMW support?
Yes, I believe, or the lower of that, or the gap amount, I believe.
All right, so based upon that, how would it become less equitable over time, the funding to school districts, in view of the fact that you have that $500 or the 10% as a limitation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, if I have your question correctly, I think the fact is that even within that, there are varying amounts that could, because of property wealth, that could be raised. And what this tries to do is then deal with those variations.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Sure.
Well, I'm having trouble with that because the current law says that the maximum that you can raise through the local option is $500, or there's two other limits. It's one of those limits, but the maximum would be $500. And it might have been 10% of the ADMW. I know there was a clear limit there. In your testimony, it says that over time it may become less equitable, but some of those districts are already, they've already picked up the maximum they could pick up. I believe like Portland, I think, came close to picking up the maximum they could pick up. So how over time does that become more inequitable? If there's that clear limit in the statute in terms of what you can raise through the local option.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, I believe that the majority of school districts fall below the $500 per student limit and the 10% of the general purpose grant limit. And so there is quite a bit of variation in terms of the dollars per student that can be raised. The other issue is that the equity grant also addresses inequities to the property taxpayer, because in one district, the same effort will raise many fewer dollars than in another district.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Sure. Steve, you want to interject?
Yes, as for technically they aren't limits, they're exclusions from local revenue in the formula.
Okay.
But beyond that, I'd have to go back and reread the language, but I think the funds excluded are probably just the property taxes. And so that the equalized $8 use realization wouldn't be included in that test.
And the question I'm asking, though, is the statutory cap is set at $500 or 10%.
Yes.
Right? So over time, if anything, it seems to me it would grow less inequitable, because more districts would be able to get closer to the maximum of $500 or 10%. Because they'd grow up to the cap. So over time, I don't see how it becomes less equitable. I think it becomes more equitable.
Okay, who wants to defend that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wett, I understand your point that there would be more districts that could get closer to the $500 per student. I believe, though, that many of the property poor districts would just not seek levies. They, their taxpayers would not be able to afford to support a levy at any level.
Follow-up? But doesn't this only apply to districts that pass levies?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, yes, that's true, but we also believe that there might be an incentive for districts to seek a levy if there is some kind of a small matching grant, and also that taxpayers might be more inclined to support a levy if there were some state grant that would follow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anybody else for these two witnesses? Okay, thank you very much. Representative Jensen. I'm sorry, what?
Actually, Nancy had some tests.
Oh,
I'm sorry. I ended up turning to her to answer technical questions.
Okay, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I have provided written testimony to you. The department does support House Bill 2300. I believe that between the two of us, Gene and I have made the points that we thought were important. The bill does support the progress that Oregon has made in equalizing school funding. And we believe it will provide some incentives for districts to pass grant, pass local levies, and for taxpayers to support them. And again, just to mention that we do believe there is a small technical amendment needed in that in the formula calculation.
Okay. Thank you very much. Representative Jensen, do you want to bring your constituents up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I would like to introduce to you the superintendent of the Pendleton School District, Mr. Jim Keene, who is here to testify for you today. I would also like to thank the chair and members of the committee for their indulgence in hearing 2300 first, since it is 250 miles from here to Pendleton, plus or minus some change. And since the superintendent has or hopes to be home tonight for a basketball game, the girls' basketball game, the conference championship with Hermiston, had the Hermiston superintendent here in the building today, but he didn't have the courage to stay. I think his nerves were too much on end and needed to get home. I also have Mr. Bob Reese with the Pendleton School District that's here in the audience, and would like to introduce to you then Mr. Keene, and he can go ahead with his testimony.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Keene, welcome.
Thank you very much, Chair Shetterly, and thank you for that introduction, Representative Jensen. And we fortunately won't need a Kansas City tiebreaker this evening for basketball. So with, I guess you can see with the testimony, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that Pendleton School District is one of those districts that is fortunate from one respect, in that we have submitted a local option tax to our community, and we're one of those communities where the public stepped up. And our public, I want to, I guess, spend a second to brag about Pendleton. Pendleton, as you'll notice on the table that was presented in earlier testimony, that when the school districts are ranked, ordered, and assessed value on a per-student basis from the highest, which you could say is the most
property wealthy district rank order down to the lowest or the least property wealthy district, that we fall on the fourth page of the list. And just about at the lowest, right at the break between the 25th percentile going up. But our community did step up in a big way with the authority that they had before them to support a local option. They supported it at over the 54% passage rate, and they came out in a double majority election in the March elections with over 60% turnout. And I guess I want to share that one reason that we think that they were willing to do that is that we already knew that when the authority was re-granted school districts, the governor had come out with the concept of ballot measure one, including an equalization concept. And we shared that with our voters, with our patrons, when we communicated about the issue. That was one of our hopes. We think it was a step that helped bring support, that there would be an extra incentive. It's an incentive for local effort, for the local voters in a property poor by comparison school district to step up in partnership, recognizing that although they have to tax themselves at a higher rate, dollar rate, to raise the same funds, or in general tax themselves and just receive less in a dollar per student basis. And this is a positive trade-off. It's a positive trade-off that we've summarized in our comments that when ballot measure one was approved by the voters in November, we saw that as a second victory for Pendleton schools, because this created the authority for this measure that's now being presented through House Bill 2300 as the implementing legislation. You can see that the range of assessed value is quite significant, with the highest district, it's almost $1.5 million per student, and in the lowest, it goes down to $115,000 per student. Pendleton is not the least property wealthy district. It's not the poorest, but on that end, it's $218,948 assessed value per student. We certainly do endorse the bill, and we certainly urge the passage of this ballot measure. I mean, of this measure to implement that portion of the ballot measure. We see this as one step in fairness in going back into the levy business, in going back into the local option tax business in our state, bringing the local communities back into a type of partnership with the states. The playing field is uneven, and this is a way of leveling that playing field.
Okay, thank you. Questions for Mr. Keene? I think we had some questions earlier about some examples off the page, and you've given us a good one of a real life story in the way this affects the Pendleton School District.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, if I could add just a little bit further clarification on the question one question that came up as far as the three bases for determining the threshold of authority for running a local issue. One is the $500 level per student, and one is the 10%. But I think for most of us, it turned into the gap threshold that became the limit for us, the gap between the measure 5 limit and the ballot measure 50 limit. So I guess I wanted to point out that I guess from our perspective, the place where Mr. Chair and Representative Witt is the clarification I guess that I thought I could add on that is that what I think will happen through time is that in districts that already tend to have high property wealth, proportionately they'll probably even gain more property wealth compared to a property poor community. They will tend to be a district that has a large industrial base or a large commercial property base. Those communities will tend to continue to grow at a higher rate than the property poor communities that tend to be
a little more stagnant in growth. And so I guess that's where I would see the gap widening, and that gap widening can affect the gap authority that's there with the threshold that really becomes the threshold that's controlling for us.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Witt.
Mr. Keene, on that point, the gap between Measure 5 and Measure 50 for virtually all districts over time will grow. I think you're alluding to the fact that the gap for your district was $220 for ADMW, I think the gap between 5 and 50. But that gap will grow, which became your limiting factor, that or $500 or the 10%, so that became the limiting factor. But isn't it true that $220 over time will become a bigger number?
Actually, are you talking, when you're looking at the table, the $218,000 in assessed value for penalty?
I'm looking at the gap.
Yeah, okay, the gap per two.
The gap per ADM.
I guess
for Pendleton School District, isn't it $220?
It's $220 was by this model,
mm-hmm.
and actually, from the time of when we submitted our ballot measure to the voters, we going into the calculations, we were optimistic that this $683,000 limit for our local option, based on that $220 gap, would be valid. We actually had compression affect our district, and so instead of a widening gap, we had a reduced gap. And so our measure, by the time we submitted it to our voters, was actually down from these figures. So it was submitted at $542,000 per year. So for Pendleton, it's actually compressed our authority and our eligibility based on the formula adjustment that was just described earlier. We would actually receive a lower maximum equalization grant as a consequence of that gap reduction and our authority reduction on the local option limit.
Follow up, Mr.
Mm-hmm.
Chairman?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it would seem to me, and maybe someone, maybe Steve could comment on this, but it would seem to me that the clear trend over time is that the gap between 5 and 50 is going to grow, so that there would be more opportunity for school districts to levy a local option within that gap. And eventually, for most districts, that gap would come up to $500 or more, which then would become the cap for most school districts from the local option.
Do you want to address that?
Generally, we would expect the gap to grow. As long as real market value is growing at least more than 3%
mm-hmm.
a year. So, yes, the gap would likely increase.
Yeah, so the point that I'm making is that over time, it would seem to me that the limiting factor to more and more school districts would be the $500 figure from the local option measure, which for your district right now is the gap number. It's the 200 and some dollars, the
right
gap number. But over time, it seems to me more and more districts are coming up or close to that $500 limit, and that becomes the operative limit in terms of local option.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wood, it's my only clarification on that, and I hope you're right. I mean, from the sense that would create more capacity for our community, and I sense our community to be willing, and so we will find out, to step up if that capacity is available. It's just that looking at through the last year, that wasn't the pattern that we saw in our community.
Mr. Chair, can I have
yes.
a little more question?
Sure.
You talk about the incentive for your voters to approve this because the possibility of some additional money coming after you had approved your local option levy. In reality, though, isn't it true that those dollars that would go into an equalization grant otherwise could have gone into the formula, and thus we're taking away money from other districts that are not in the same position your district's in, but also passed a local option. So in other words, they passed a local option, they get an additional $300-$500 per student, but then by approving this equalization grant, we're taking money out of the formula, and thus for those very same school districts that are passing local options, they're losing money on the backside.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wood, I guess I don't think that was what the voters assumed in passing ballot measure one. And I guess I think in passing ballot measure one, they saw the issue of even going back to levies, to local option tax levies, as a step away from total state funding, and a step toward a local share, and this matter of local equalization as being just part of that. I mean, we're all in the best of times. We would love to be out of the levy business again. We would love to be in a position where we could expect complete adequate resources, even now to the level of the quality ed model to be funded. But I guess our expectation isn't that high with these times. Our voters stepped up with the local option. I'm going to call it Pendleton pride and say that they stepped up knowing that they wanted to maintain as close as possible to a stable program. We in Pendleton, we've actually downsized $1.3 million from our operating budget through the last 2 years. This was a way to kind of limit those cuts. And I guess from the perspective of a property poor district, I think the sense that because the dollars that can be raised are limited by the property wealth of our community, this is a matter of fairness in our sense to allow that higher tax rate ability by the property wealthy district.
Okay. Representative Beck.
So I've got a kind of a broad question, you're here and you're from Eastern Oregon, so maybe you can take a crack at it. I represent Portland, and there's all the statistics show that the metro area subsidizes, and we pay more in taxes than we get back. That's very true in terms of school funding. How do I, and I know that Portland this year is projecting another, we've got a $10 million deficit. We're going to have to make $10 million of cuts if we don't sell more buildings, fire more teachers. You know, we've laid off a lot of, several hundred people too. So how do I, what do I tell my constituents who passed a local option like your people? How do I explain this to them that this, and I realize this, and I don't mean this in a threatening way. I'm really looking for some philosophical help here. How do I explain to my constituents that we're thinking of taking yet more money and sending it out to other communities who don't have the taxing capacity? We have taxing capacity, but we a lot of costs associated with that. We choose to live there. How would you respond to that in terms of this is just another additional subsidy, for lack of a better term, to different communities, different places with different characteristics, and at the expense of my families and kids in my community?
Mr. Chair and Representative Beck, I guess I think I'd give them two answers.
Okay.
I think the first answer that I would share is that in the past legislative session, when the authority was re-granted to go back to local communities for local levels, for that local support, that was a contrast to a state equalizing system that made funding uniform, much more uniform. The reason that I think that happened without a big negative reaction from the property poor communities and districts in the state was based on the hope that ballot measure one would come along, and it was based on I think all of us in the school business have become pragmatists, and we realize if there's not enough state resource available, we have to have the ability to turn locally, and so that was seen as at least some hope to be complete. And so for the high property wealth districts, that was much more of a viable solution than for the property poor districts. From the property poor district first, for the property poorest district to even sell any tax increase will be more difficult. Second, it will generate so much less per pupil. So I think part of the argument to the citizen and school district in a higher property wealth area, higher capacity area, is that there's a better return. There's a better chance for the win at the polls, and there's a better return when it's voted in on a per-student basis. And then the other second point that I would make is that the public spoke rather clearly with ballot measure 1. When ballot measure 1 was passed, although there was a conditional to one part of that, one component of the ballot measure, so this, they spoke, in, I guess, in the, from a school school from an educator perspective, I guess I feel they spoke about the relative priority of funding schools because they said to fund schools adequately. But there was some escape language there to say or to explain why it wasn't possible. But the second portion of ballot measure 1 didn't have the conditional. It said that there shall be an equalization for the local effort of local option elections. And so I would say to them too that we have to go with the will of the public in the of the public in our state. And I guess I'm assuming that I bet my prediction is that that was even probably supported by people in property rich areas as well as property poor areas.
Mm-hmm. All right, I want to thank you very much, both of you, for coming over yesterday, I guess, and wish you good travel back. I hope you make it back in time to the game.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Jensen. Let's bring up, just going down the list then, Don Schoenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Don Schoenberg, Associate Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau. Appreciate the opportunity today to speak on House Bill 2300. It is our position that the funding source for this bill runs counter to basic tax philosophy. Simply stated, the philosophy asserts that property taxes should be used to finance property-related services, and a tax based on the person's ability to pay should be used to fund services that are for the general benefit of society. Whether you like the ballot measure or not, back when we made that change, we made the correct philosophical change, and we began to fund schools primarily from income tax rather than property tax. Schools are not a property-related service like police and fire and protection, police and fire protection or roads. Elementary and high schools are a social service for the general benefit of society and are appropriately financed with a tax based on a person's ability to pay. Since we're not funding schools primarily by property taxes, I don't know that the property wealth per student is a proper way to determine if there is equity and opportunity between school districts. Rather, it might be taxable income per student, not the students themselves, of course, but I mean taxable income in the district divided by the number of students would be more appropriate in determining whether they're a rich district or a poor district for funding education. In any case, a local district option for property taxes as a condition for receiving equalization funding for a school is not appropriate. The correct method is embodied in a bill that was just introduced in the Senate this week, Senate Bill 532, introduced by Senator Lee Beyer and Representative Morissette. The bill establishes procedures by which a school district can obtain voter approval and enact a local option income, sales, or other tax. While we're not real excited about the sales tax concept, it too is a tax based on a person's ability to pay. These two legislators clearly understand the philosophy of taxation because their bill also prohibits a local option property tax for schools. In conclusion, if equalization conditioned by the passage of a local option tax is a valid concept, the Oregon Farm Bureau supports amending House Bill 2300 to delete the property tax aspect and incorporate Senate Bill 532. Thank you for allowing me to make these comments today.
Representative Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Schoenberg, I'm having trouble understanding why your proposal addresses the concern relative to equity. Different districts have different levels of income. Some districts have a lot of very high-income people. Some districts have a lot of very low-income people. Shifting a local option tax to an income tax instead of a property tax still has the inherent iniquity that has been pointed out to us in terms of the likelihood of people supporting it or the amount of revenue that a tax would generate. So how does this address the issue of equity in terms of local option taxes?
Mr. Chair, Representative, you're right. You still have the same problem in equity, and I don't know that that makes it any easier or any harder to pass a local option tax. But the ability to pay that tax isn't based on the value of the property that's in the district. The ability to pay that tax is based on what people earn and what they can pay, not on what the value of their property is. And all I'm saying is that is the fair way of determining a person the equalization opportunity for the students in the district.
If I can follow, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Well, the ability to pay on income, you could say that's true of any tax. I mean, you could use that argument, it would seem to me, couldn't you, to say there shouldn't be any property tax. It should all be income tax, because ability to pay in that argument for schools would work the same way for anything else.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, what the beginning of my testimony indicated, the tax philosophy, property taxes are appropriate for property-related services, roads, police, fire, those things that are property-related. Those are appropriate for property taxes. Schools are not a property-related service. Schools are a social service for the general benefit of society. Those are issues, those are services that should be paid for based on your ability to pay. You make a greater income, you have received greater benefit from society, and so you have a greater responsibility to care for society and for those general services.
Don, I'm not sure, is your objection related so much to this bill as it is to the local option bill that we passed last session? Because this bill doesn't use local property tax. It just uses that as a reference point for the equalization purposes. It's the bill last session that authorizes the local option property tax. This is general fund dollars coming out in this equalization grant.
Mr. Chairman, you're right, I think, on that point now. But my understanding, and as I read the bill, and I may be misunderstanding this, but I thought in order to get this equalization money, you had to pass a local option tax.
You do, under the bill that was passed last session.
But and under, now this bill doesn't, well, okay, so that actually refers back to the bill of last session.
Right.
I apologize. Then I understand what you're saying, and I apologize if my comments are inappropriate for this bill. But I did want to make that point, which I apparently have done, in my opinion, the bill last session was incorrect. I'd like to see that changed. Then if we can go back that
far. How about measure 50? Okay, any more questions for Don? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's see. Let's bring up a couple together here. Lori Wimmer-Whalen and Ozzy Rose. Ozzy, why don't you come on up, too? I think you had some answers to Representative Witt's questions, as I understand. Lori, you go ahead and go first.
All right. Good afternoon. For the record, Lori Wimmer-Whalen with the Oregon Education Association. A couple points. OEA worked to develop the power equalization model in the 1999 session, which many of you may remember started out as an amendment to the original local option bill and then became the aforementioned noted minority report. We also helped in the last election cycle to gather signatures that got ballot measure 1 on the ballot. And we are here today to support House Bill 2300, which, by the way, we do not see as a policy debate so much as just the technical implementation of something that voters overwhelmingly passed in the year 2000. So with that, I'd like to go through why it is we feel it's important for this to go through all the way. First of all, we do believe that Oregon's march to equalization has been an important one in the decade following the passage of ballot measure 5, and we wouldn't want to see local option disrupt that march, and we believe that the original language of the local option bill does, because, as you've heard repeatedly, those with the capacity to make that effort to get to the $500 per kid can do so much more easily if they have a lot of commercial and industrial property and wealthy individual taxpayers with expensive properties than if they live in areas that are economically depressed and have low-value properties. And so we would rather see the local option levy, in effect, to put it crudely, value each kid as having the same worth, irrespective of the community in which they live. So the second piece is that we have seen polls over time that show that when you say to a local voter, if you knew that this extra dollar on your property tax were going to be matched by some other source, would you be more likely to vote yes? And the answer overwhelmingly is yes, that they believe that if they could leverage their own dollars with other sources, they're much more apt to approve the local option to begin with. And so we think that this enables those lesser wealthy districts to have a chance politically at the ballot box with their local options in their communities. And then finally, we've seen that the Kansas plan has worked, or at least that's what we've heard anecdotally from our colleagues, and so we felt that that was a good model. And so giving credit where it's due, Jim Scherzinger and Representative Jeff Merkley and I were the three who worked out this model. A question earlier was, why the 75% line? Frankly, it was arbitrary. But in Mr. Scherzinger's estimation, it was a plausible place to draw the line. And to Representative Haas's earlier question, why would Beaverton necessarily be that marker? It was 2 years ago as well, the place where the line happened to draw. So it hasn't changed much in 2 years in any case. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Questions?
Representative Witt. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lori, you said this is really a technical follow-up to the ballot measure. Language in the ballot measure says, quote, consistent with such legal obligation as it may have to maintain substantial equity in state funding, comma, the Legislative Assembly. In reality, I think we had testimony on this in 1999 when we passed the local option that there was no problem in terms of the requirement of substantial equity with the local option the way it was passed. If that's true, that would lead me to conclude that there's no legal obligation for the legislature to do anything to change the law from 1999 to be consistent with constitutional requirements. Is that true?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Witt, I guess I respectfully disagree. I think that it says the amount of such grants and eligibility criteria shall be determined by the Legislative Assembly, doesn't it?
Yeah, but the preamble to that is consistent with such legal obligation as it may have to maintain substantial equity in state funding. So, and I think that gets to the uniform schools issue in terms of substantial equity, which goes back to the court cases. And as I recall from 1999, the testimony was that the local option as we passed it was consistent with that legal obligation of providing a uniform public school system.
Chair Shetterly, Representative Witt, I'm not a CPA, but I would submit that...
I think you need to be a constitutional lawyer.
Okay, yeah. Well, whatever. I'm not that as well. But what I would say is that I know that there was testimony that was that would have disputed that contention. I think that the issue still gets back to the capacity of local communities in terms of their wherewithal.
If I can follow up,
sure, you bet.
Chairman. Maybe you could address another concern that I voiced earlier, and that's this. If let's take Portland, for example, okay, which is above the line here. Portland votes for the local option, but if Portland, which brings in substantial additional dollars that can be used in the Portland schools, but if Portland voters also know that if other communities who are below the line vote for the local option, they have a situation that more of the dollars, the incremental dollars that they're being taxed are staying in their school district. Other dollars that they might have been getting through the state formula are not coming in because they're going to these districts that are supplementing their local options. Isn't it true that these dollars that would go into these equalization grants otherwise could have gone into the state school formula and thus been spread out through all of the districts? And if that's true, aren't we taking away money from those school districts above the line to subsidize those districts below the line?
Chair Shetterly and Representative Witt, or Professor Witt, I think that's another philosophical question, and I suppose you could say that about every single dime the state appropriates with respect to the general fund, that those are dollars that theoretically could be going into the state school fund. I think that policy decisions are your purview, not mine. We're bringing a proposal forward that we believe makes it easier for all communities to find ways to have a local contribution to the total cost of educating children.
I think good people can disagree about whether or not this is the mechanism to do it, but it's the one that we would hope that you would consider, because we believe that the voters did believe they had weighed in on this.
Ozzie.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for record, I'm Ozzie Rose with the Oregon School Administrators Association, and I asked to come up in part for Representative Witt's concerns and Representative Beck, because they, since you're asking the same question, and the representative asked it again just now, and the answers to their corrections or their questions are yes. But I would like to encourage you to take a broader view of where we've been and what we've got and where we're going. We're not solving the equity problem today with this bill. We're not solving it with our current equity formula. We started back in the early 80s with a system in which some of our very low property wealth districts were spending less than half of what other districts were spending to try to run their schools, and property taxes were going up and so forth, and that led to a revolt that led to Measure 5, et cetera, and changed the funding system. And you're all well aware of that, even though you've weighed in on it in terms of your current responsibilities a little bit later. And we took a blanket and put over the entire state and said, now do it all the same everywhere. And we had done it all differently everywhere. Programs were different, dollars per kids were different, and we've been struggling through this decade of balancing the interest of all kids of Oregon with the problems of robbing and taking from, et cetera, to create something called equity. We won't have equity until we have every kid with equal access, a term that you used on me this morning, Representative, equal access to programs, and we don't have that now. The courts drove us toward an equal dollar approach, and I don't view this, I view this as important, one of the important things for right now, to help the lower wealth districts pass some, get some property tax to help their programs. In the end, in a decade from now, I would suggest that the formula may look different, and this may look different also. I think this is it. This gave Pendleton a shot at their situation. It gives other districts a shot at their situation. It is not the final answer. And it, you know, when we started the equity formula, the first thing we did was take money from Portland. Brother Beaverton, Representative, was on the receiving side the first year we put the formula in effect, and they flipped over to a rich district overnight and didn't realize it. But the first time we implemented the formula, we held the so-called wealthier districts by this same measure to the amount of money they had the prior year, and then we gave to districts out in the hinterland a 25% increase in operations. And that was the biggest switch in the terms of the move toward equity. And this isn't perfect, but it's one more component, and you and your successors are going to refine it over the next several sessions with the ultimate end, a system in which every kid in Oregon has access to the same kind of program, meets the standards we ask them to meet. We also, in that process, we now have a target in terms of the quad education model laying out what it is it takes to do what we're asking the kids to do. So you're no longer just shooting in the dark with what are we going to do for schools this time around. And so I would encourage you to look at this as maybe imperfect, and very imperfect for some districts, but as part of a total set of things that will eventually get us where we want to go. And I'd add one other thing. Oregon is the only state that has tried to create equity in the school funding without pouring a lot of extra money into it. Every other state that has made the move to equity has bought the lower wealth districts, lower spending districts up. And during the 90s, we have not done that. We've created the degree of equity we have without an enormous increase in funding for schools. We've had an increase, but not the kind that saved the problem. If we could have brought everybody up to Portland's level of funding, then we wouldn't have had any howls. And so it's been a difficult task, and I think that's just one part of it, and I encourage you to move ahead with the bill.
Questions? Representative Bates.
I first apologize for having left in the middle of this because I really wanted to hear the discussion. I had a sick patient upstairs. One of our members was sick. Okay, so I apologize for leaving. It's the fourth case today. I don't know what's going on in this building.
I think we call this house calls.
Oh. That's worse than the Kansas plan. I understand the basic philosophy behind this, I believe, that and it is, and we should be upfront about the fact that we are shifting monies from one district to another to equalize opportunity for kids. In my particular district, I have one of the richest school districts in the state and one of the poorest. And I understand that shift, and we've actually talked to both school boards in the state and my district about it. They understand that. The question I have really relates to something that Representative Witt has tried to bring up to me here, and that is there's a $500 cap of some type that I want to hear more about. He asked the question earlier, and if this is a bad time or wrong time to ask that question, I would delay and talk to you in private. But I'd like to hear that explanation, what that really means.
My view of what it really means is that you're not going to let a district get so far out by levying this that it becomes a rich district at the expense of the richer districts. The 500 cap was to try to put a lid. The poor district that you're talking about, if they could get enough from this and raise their revenue by $4,000 a kid, and then they're the rich district at the expense of your other district that hasn't been able to take advantage of it. I believe that's what the 500 cap is all about. With all due respect to your concerns, there was some thought as to this is one part of the equity thing, and you've got to move a ways, but you can't go forever. Beaverton and Portland, or Tigard, Park Rose is up there. You can't fund everything off of those districts for all the other districts. So it's a cap for that reason. And by the way, I think if you get where all those districts, if you won't in your term, if you get where all those districts below the 75th percentile all were at the $500 cap, you probably have a different statute related to this issue.
Chair Shetterly and Representative Bates, and to clarify, perhaps we should say that the $500 or the amount in the gap of the 10% is a matter of statute now based on the 1999 local option law, not this measure.
I have one question, and Jean, you might want to listen because you might have the answer. I know the governor did some polling. Well, let me back up. Measure one really had two components. One was let's fund schools. The other part was what we're dealing with here. And I raise that because I think they are two distinct questions. And I know the governor has done some polling as to Measure 7, I think it is. Is that right? Have we heard that in the news reports?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe it was the governor per se.
Well, somebody did some polling to determine what the message was from Measure 7. Has there been any polling as to Measure 1? It was two components, and I guess the question is what was the sentiment of the voters, do we know, with respect to these different components?
Mr. Chair, Gene Thornton, I don't recall that there was any, may have been some polling done prior to putting Measure 1 together. I would like to note, though, that because of some of the other questions that have come up, and actually referring back to the local option bill last time, the governor was inclined to veto this bill. Not this bill, that bill.
I remember.
And it was a very difficult decision, and there were certainly plenty of school people coming in and saying, veto the bill because it will take, if we have the local option, it may take the pressure off the legislature. And because of these equity issues, that an area that is a higher property wealth could probably pass something that wouldn't have to be as much and get quite a bit. And the concept that was in then the minority report, he had said he would have signed while the discussions were going on. His willingness to sign, at the same time, during that time period, the 30 days after the session when he needed to decide whether to sign or veto, was the same time period as he was looking at what types of ballot measures he might want to move forward. And the concepts around the local both concepts that are included in Measure 1 were really key to him signing the local option bill, of saying he was concerned about the equity for those school districts that came in and patrons, I should say more so, school districts that came in and said, said, but we don't want to wait until after a measure passes. We like we need to do it now, because one of the thoughts was veto that bill, try to put forward on the ballot a measure that was more along the lines of the minority report. And he was willing to sign the bill knowing that he was going to put this forward and that hopefully, and I think at that time, issues around equity and adequacy were ones that voters, it resonated with voters. And so I think that relates to when voters passed ballot Measure 1, what did they think they were voting on, but certainly in terms of as the governor put Measure 1 together and how it interacted with the local option bill that was actually passed last time and his concerns about does this move us away from equalization.
Thank you for that.
Mr. Chair.
Recollection of the history. Representative Beck and then Hess.
Question for some information. Ozzy, you mentioned that other states have put more in their direction or efforts toward equalization. They've actually put more money, and I'd love to see that documentation and share that with people in the building and how other people have arrived at this, other states over the last decade. If you, either of you have, can get that in a way that's presentable to 25 freshman House members and the rest of us term-limited people, I think that would be just helpful historical context. I guess one question or again approach to this, the formula has been relatively static, and I feel like we keep making changes, little changes like the local option and then this bill, but we aren't necessarily looking at other pieces of the puzzle. And it seems to me in this dynamic of this piece we're being asked to make, it begs the question, well, maybe we need to look at, you know, constantly looking at the whole the system. We seem to be unable to change the funding formula for all the complicated reasons we all know. But I guess I'd be more interested in looking at this, at implementing this the way it's been proposed, if we're also looking at the other moving pieces, take an aggressive look, and that includes maybe more funding or other creative things we need to be doing. It's just hard to look at this by itself and not think about the sorts of issues that I and Representative Witt and I think others around here are raising. And I don't know, that's a comment and based on, you know, 3 weeks sitting on this committee dealing with complicated issues. I just, this whole issue of, Mr. Chairman, if you'll indulge me, this whole issue of equal access to meet standards, we all want that. And we want a funding system that guarantees every kid in the state and Pendleton and Dufour and Portland and Riverdale and, you know, equal access to meet state standards. But at some point, it seems reasonable that to go above and beyond that, communities ought to be able to make those choices. I make a choice to live in a community where if I leave anything in my car at night, it's going to get stolen. Yeah, that's a choice I make, that community, but it comes with other benefits, a higher property tax base, schools that can, or school districts that might be able to take advantage of that tax base to do other things. It seems to me at some point in this whole notion to equalization, we also have to acknowledge that above and beyond a certain point of equity and equal access to achieving standards, communities ought to be able to go above and beyond that based on their unique characteristics and the choices that people make who've chosen to live in those communities. And this whole notion of exact amount or roughly exact amount of dollars to the number of students, just I wrestle with it, and I don't know enough about the court decisions and whether there we have latitude to start setting up a system that allows people to do more, provided that that basic equal access to achieve standards is achieved. But Yeah, this is a whole, I'm not being as articulate as I'd like, but I'm really wrestling with just implementing this way, in this context of equalization. I'm troubled.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck and Ozzie or Lori may have much better answers than I have. But let me go back to Measure One again, as I was talking about. I think the governor really saw, and again, the concerns about the local option bill. That did that move us? I mean, he understood the desire to allow local voters to add dollars to their schools. At the same time, he was concerned about the issue of sufficiency, and he was concerned that by allowing that, was it an equal allowance? That's why you have both of those pieces together in Measure One. Does it solve all the, I mean, this committee, and I think probably the Senate committee right now, is wrestling with all the various formula changes. So the issues around distribution are issues I'm sure we're going to be dealing with over the coming years. But I think our sense is that not this bill alone, Measure One, does provide a framework for beginning to change the way we budget for schools, how we identify it when we come up with a number. It's not just picking a number. The 5.2 that you see wasn't, well, here's a number. The 5.2 was with the expectation we're purchasing certain things, and the $5 million for local option was on top of that. But that within the context of still allowing local voters, that if we were going to do that, that there should be some attempt at the same time to not let it get far out of line and to allow it really to be more of an option that was available to different districts, and it wasn't out of reach based on the fact that you're a very poor property wealth district. Ozzie or Lori may have other comments.
Only thing I'd like to share is that the issue of equal program, equal access to program, everybody believes in that. Mm-hmm. And it was a lot easier to believe in it before we had computers. Because as soon as we get the numbers and put a computer run, everybody forgets about what we're talking about. They look at the rundown of where my district is, not just you guys, but the scoop of everybody. Now, those computer runs are, they drive what we think of equity. And that's, in some respects, unfortunate, but also gives you good information. The other thing that I would share is that I think if we could wipe out our income tax, our sales tax, our property tax, and start all over, and write a tax system that we thought was fair, met everybody's needs, would probably look different than what we have. We don't have that luxury. And I concluded a long time ago with this biennial legislative process that life is a series of 2 years events, and I need to do everything I can do in this 2 years, and it won't be done, and we'll work on the next 2 years. And getting the people the right to go back and do some voting locally, I think, was very important beyond whether they passed the Pendleton election or not. One of the unintended consequences of Measure 5 that I think, I feel very strong about this, schools didn't like running the levy elections, and we used to complain about it. But the thing we lost with Measure 5 was a reason to talk to our communities. Mm. The superintendent had to go to coffee clutches and all that stuff and work hard at a levy. Now, in the 80s, we had to do too many of them. But the fact is, that was the place that there was interaction, and school communities, or communities decided what they wanted for schools. And when we did away with the ability to vote on anything locally, you know, our budget committees are almost zip as far as who shows up and so forth, and we lost that. And I thought that, not everybody agrees with this, but I think that's one of the important things that Measure 1 did for us, was help get us back into local levy of business. And it's not a huge amount. It's not in terms of, and it may be, down the road, if everybody gets to that cap, then your successors are going to have to do something different. But I think you have to look at, and we, you know, your remark about wanting to look at the whole formula. Trouble with looking at the formula, it probably needs to be looked at. But when you have a zero sum of game, every move you make is a plus and a minus. And last spring, I, for our superintendent's group that works on this all the time, I ran the formula without every one of the factors separately. Took the factor out completely. And I had a stack of paper, probably a huge forest And I had runs for about every idea you could have. And there's 40 of them. They had all these runs. And wow, that's a good idea. Oops, this one isn't a good idea. And pretty soon they concluded, that's why we came into the session, was don't mess with the formula, because all it does is shift money around. It's not perfect. It needs more work. And next session, you're going to have to work on it. And I think this is a small part of that total package.
Sorry, before I come to you, let me say I'm going to predict that we will not get to our hearing on House Bill 2299, the Stabilization Fund, today. we have some afternoon committees that we need to accommodate. I will apologize to those of you who may have come for that. I hope that you have, if not enjoyed, at least been challenged by the discussion we've had today, even if you weren't here for this one. This has been one of the most engaging discussions, both philosophical and practical and impractical, I think, that I've had the occasion to sit in for a long time. So this has been very, very constructive. But I want to say that in case you're just hanging on and hoping we might get to a minute hearing on 2299, we won't. We'll reschedule that probably for next week. Is it on tomorrow? It's next week. It'll be next week. Okay. Laura, if you want to respond, then Representative Haskell has a question.
All right.
And then we'll have to wrap up.
Chair Shetterly and Representative Beck, I'll be brief. First of all, I just wanted to echo everything Ozzie just said. I can be much more brief thanks to him. Because he said everything I was going to say about the tax burden and the tax system and the community aspect. But I would add, Representative Beck, you said something about speaking to your constituents, and as one of them, let me just say, I too chose to live in that neighborhood, but I think the children of the various communities in this state do not make those choices. They're born into families, and they're born into communities, and they live where they live. And but to your constituents, I would suggest, and this is a larger question that answers a lot of the ones that have been asked today, one of the aspects that we don't often talk about when we talk about tax dollars leaving one district and funding something somewhere else and how that seems like we're subsidizing them over there, there's a lot of parochialism in the tones of that. And the fact is, when communities are not in good health and when they are in decline, people leave. The next generation, at least, leaves. They look for jobs. They seek a better quality of life. And I would suggest that as we grapple with the urban density issues in the city of Portland, one of the things that we have to think about is how many folks are moving in and why. And I would say that as we look at education as a statewide issue, one of the things that we achieve with good, stable, equitable funding is healthy communities elsewhere in the state so that they're not all coming to our neighborhood. Because, you know, we've got a big state and a lot of places to live. And I think that that's, in some sense, an insurance policy for those in our community that the other communities are as healthy and that their education systems are able to function and have a good fiscal health.
Representative Pass.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think there's anybody in this committee who doesn't want to help kids in poor school districts. But, Ozzie, you asked to look at this broadly, and when I look at this broadly, I do share some of the same sentiments as Representative Beck and Witt, in that a lot of these school districts in the top quarter percentile, and actually most of the Portland area and the Willamette Valley area, pay most of the bills, pay the lion's share of the bills for not just schools but other state services. And that's fine with me. My misgivings to some extent are that there's not always a reciprocity in coming from those areas to the state when it comes to Portland issues, be it transportation, be it other a project in Portland, a project in Beaverton. And in fact, for example, some of the rural school districts want to take the timber money out of the formula. Some of those kinds of issues kind of eat away at me. And that's kind of my frustration. And so when I look broadly, that's kind of how I feel.
Mr. Chair, we're fighting hard to keep the federal force fees in the formula where it belongs. But you are correct. I think that probably if people were really careful and honest, most of the money that runs this state comes out of Clackamas, Washington, Multnomah County. That's a fact. But we have people everywhere, and that struggle is the balance. And you people down here, you're no different than the group of superintendents I work with. I mean, they have the legislation. In fact, yesterday I told them that I know all you've been talking, because every dumb idea that you've had has turned up, excuse me, every idea that you've had has turned up in legislation. But everybody lives where they live, looks out for their interest. In the end, we have to have a compromise that makes Oregon a livable state. And I would, with great honesty, put forth that this is a part of that package, and it does a number of things, including reintroducing communities to the election process and talking to their schools about what they want in them.
And Representative Wick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ozzie, last session, 99, when we passed this, as I recall, what we were saying is that the formula provides a certain basic level of support. We're going to give an option to local communities to enhance that up to a limit, because we were concerned about the equalization issue. And this was viewed as additional funding that a local community could provide to enhance the basic school support. We realized there was going to be a certain inequity in that, if you will. But it seems to me that that goes right to the heart of what you're suggesting. And the problem with one of the problems with Measure 5 is this disconnection that we've created between local communities supporting their schools and their schools asking for that support and having local community responsibility. But looking at the flip side of your view of that on this particular bill, the flip side of this is a Portland or a Beaverton, which might pass the local option, so they're even paying more money into their schools. When schools like a Pendleton, and I'm not picking on Pendleton, I'm sure it's a wonderful school district, but when they pass a local option, now we're going to subsidize it with additional dollars that could have gone into the formula. So what we're doing to a Beaverton or a Portland is we're, once again, re-engaging this disconnect. We're asking you to put more of your own dollars into your schools. We'll keep them here. In the meantime, on the backside, when some of these other districts pack a local option, we're going to give you less. And these are for districts that are already paying more than their appropriate share. You know, when you look at where the dollars are coming from. So I don't think this bill for all districts encourages that local responsibility, that local obligation, and reinforces it appropriately.
Representative Bates.
I'll do a little philosophizing too for a moment, then I'll be very pragmatic and ask you to do something on a very pragmatic basis. What Representative Beck and Representative Witt have said is true, and I recognize that truth. And again, I'll refer back to my own district because it's a microcosm of the state. We have one half of my district pays very high taxes because they have very high incomes, and the other half does not. And the differences in those two school systems used to be huge and dramatic, but because of ballot measure 5, is not as dramatic as it used to be. One area wants to pass a local option, and one area will never pass a local option. And I'm afraid that we'll get back to a situation where kids born in one area or the other will be in a situation where there is a significant difference in inequality as far as equality of opportunity is concerned. I think not to recognize that huge shift of funds is inappropriate. We should recognize it and then make our decision if we want to treat all the kids in Oregon the same or that kids in certain districts should be treated different than kids in another. And that's a decision that's one that's made on, I think, a philosophical basis. To be pragmatic now, this list is very interesting to me. It would be a lot more interesting to add one more thing into it. The ones that get zero from the state, I want to see what they lose from the state. How much of their general funds would get cut if a certain number of districts below the line went ahead and took the local option and the money was transferred out of the general fund to that school? Well, how would it affect the schools up above so I could have a real idea what we're talking about here? And that's going to be hard to do because you don't know how many schools are going to take the local option below the line.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, the way it's currently structured, and again, this is a two-year event, the maximum that can go out is $5 million. And $5 million is about $4 a student to the rest of the school district. That's how you can...
So we'll follow up on this particular... So my point is, for the follow-up on this particular bill, that difference is going to be negligible.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, if I can...
I asked that as a question, by the way. I didn't say, is it going to be negligible? Okay.
It depends, I think, on how you measure it, per student or per district. $4 per student is $4 per student, but you calculate
$500. I think it's
$500,000
for
$4 out of a budget of...
Mr. Chair and Representative Bates, if I might go back once more to how this budget was put together, because it wasn't put together the way it's been before, done before. We didn't pick a number
and then say, okay, whoops, we need to put $5 million over here for local option. We needed it. We use the quality education model, which is, I mean, so first we were at 5.2. Then we looked at, well, actually, the it's 5.1 something. It was the quality education model for what we were trying to buy. And the local option was on top of that. I think as Lori said earlier, you can kind of make an argument with about any expenditure in the general fund. You're taking money, you know, if we put money here, you're taking money that could have gone through the formula. I think in this particular case, because we now have a way to structure our state school fund budget, you can still argue that, but I think the argument is less solid than it may have been before.
Okay, I want to thank everybody for staying with us today. Appreciate the discussions and tough issues that are highlighted here. Not new necessarily, but in a new light perhaps.
One's on the front.
We will come back to House Bill 2229 when we can schedule that next week. By name.